Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast. Today we're looking, I'm skipping ahead actually to the Book of Threes. I think there's probably more likely to be interesting things for us here. So starting at the beginning of the Book of Threes, there is one set that jumps out as being interesting on several levels. It's a fairly basic teaching. It's very much Buddhism 101. But I'd imagine that many of the people watching this haven't heard or haven't become very familiar with it. In Buddhist culture, it's very common. So people who have studied and learned about Buddhism from throughout their lives will be quite familiar with it. And that's the teaching on the three doors, or the three aspects of experience, or more action, the three types of action, the three ways that we interact with the world around us. This is through the body, through speech, and through the mind. And it's simple and fairly basic teaching, but it's quite useful as well. See, the Buddha was very much into expedience, things that are useful. So he didn't always talk in terms of ultimate reality. Like we're studying today, the Visuddhimagga, which gets very much into the ultimate reality. It's quite dense and actually quite difficult to understand, difficult to remember, difficult to apply. It's very technical. But as far as application goes, the teaching on the three doors shouldn't be overlooked and shouldn't be discarded as simple or basic. It works on all levels of training. It's usually referred to in regards to morality. So with the body, we abstain from killing. This is a Buddhist practice. Our use of the body is a way that we do evil deeds and good deeds. We abstain from killing, we abstain from stealing, we abstain from cheating. These are all physical things that we do. And then we do physical deeds of kindness. We give charity. We give assistance. We act in ways that are beneficial to ourselves and others. With speech, we refrain from lying and backbiting and gossiping and harsh speech, useless speech. And we engage in positive speech. We say things that are true, we say things that are beneficial, we say things that are pleasant. Or sometimes that are unpleasant but necessary to say, useful and true. And with the mind, we refrain from thinking certain thoughts. Or when thoughts arise, we don't give them any credence. When thoughts of killing or stealing or lying or cheating or gossiping or lying, of doing anything bad, thoughts of harm, thoughts of aversion, thoughts of addiction, we don't give them any credence or any. We don't give them any power over us. This is morality. This is the sort of basic way of understanding these things. We should watch these doors and not let them be a conduit for evil. Let them only be a conduit for good. Easy to remember, right? Watch your body, watch your speech, watch your mind. Guard your body, guard your speech, guard your mind. These are the three things that we have to guard in Buddhism. But it also comes into play in terms of the practice of concentration. Now, concentration has to be cultivated, incorporating all three of these doors, or these tools, or these catalysts. The body we use, we practice concentration with the body. This means when we do meditation, we have a formal technique. We have to be careful when we walk that we're stepping one foot at a time, not stepping with both feet at once. We do things with the body that allow us to be concentrated. We don't just, when we stand up, we don't just get up quickly. We try to be mindful and keep our movements calm and composed. We don't play with our hands, or we don't twiddle our thumbs. We don't dance or cavort around in ways that would diffuse our concentration. Some meditation centers have you walk very slowly. You don't have to be really slow when you go, but it should be calm and composed. You have to keep bodily composure. It's called Kaya Sanyata. And with speech as well. Doesn't mean you don't speak. Of course you have to speak, otherwise you can't talk with your teacher. But when you do speak, you have to be clear and careful. So again, guarding your speech, but guarding it not just in terms of bad speech, but in terms of staying focused and concentrated. Don't talk too much. And when you do talk, be aware that you're speaking. It can actually be, even speech can be a meditation practice, should be, because speech is a source of a lot of problems, no? A lot of distraction comes from speaking. When you speak, you have to think, and if you talk a lot, and if you engage in talking about various topics, it can distract you. We shouldn't forget the fact that speaking is an action as well. And when we speak, you can be mindful of it. Mindful of the fact that your lips are moving. Mindful of the emotions that come. Mindful even of the sound of your own voice. And of course, most important with concentration is the mind. So with the mind, we cultivate concentration, focusing on one object at a time. In samatha, it's a single object. In vipassana, it's every object that arises. When an object arises, you grasp it. This is a kind of grasping that is positive. You grasp it as it is. You grasp the true nature of it. Body is body, feelings are feelings, mind is mind. Dhammas are dhammas. When you walk, knowing that the right foot is moving, grasping the movement, stepping right, stepping left, keeping your mind fixed on the object as it arises and ceases, so that you don't extrapolate upon it, you don't make more of it than it is, you don't react to it or judge it, you get carried away by it. So these three doors work very much in the practice of meditation, and for meditators they're a good thing to keep in mind, an easy way to remember. Am I being mindful of everything? Am I guarding my body, my speech, my mind? And in insight meditation, so these three also come into play in terms of wisdom. We learned today about rupa. The body can be used to cultivate wisdom. You focus on the body. When we watch the stomach rising and falling, the awareness of the stiffness and the flaccidity, using the body, it's a really powerful meditation object, because the body is gross, the body is clear, easy to find, easy to focus your attention on. When you feel the tension in your back or in your legs, all of this is body. It's a really powerful meditation object. Allows you to see impermanence, suffering, non-self, to see that everything in the body is unstable, uncontrollable, unsatisfying, not worth clinging to. Watching the body helps you let go of the body. Helps you let go, helps you find peace. Speech, in terms of wisdom, the best way is to not speak so much. But in terms of wisdom, also speaking important things, asking good questions, letting your meditation teacher know your condition so that they can give advice and commentary on your practice. Proper speech can be used to cultivate wisdom. In fact, absolutely, right? Talking like this is hopefully a catalyst or a conductive of the cultivation of wisdom. As you learn about the three doors and as you're told about the three doors, speech can be a wonderful way of learning the Dhamma, of course. But talking with your teacher, listening to your teacher, asking questions of your teacher, all very important for the cultivation of wisdom. Of course, again, the most important aspect, as in all aspects of Buddhism, the most important aspect of the cultivation of wisdom is, as well, the mind. Using the mind to cultivate wisdom, because of course that's where the wisdom arises. Not even from intellectual thinking, but it comes from the quality of the mind, the quality of the pure mind that is aware of experiences as they are, aware of the body, aware of the feelings, aware of the mind itself. It is the mind that sees things, sees impermanence, sees suffering, sees non-self. But it only sees this with the cultivation of the proper mind state. So the mind is, in the practice of wisdom, it's the most important of the three doors. We use the mind to cultivate clear awareness of things as they are. It's quite simple. I mean, it sounds somewhat lofty, and the idea of wisdom might sound somewhat pie in the sky, but wisdom is actually quite simple. It's seeing things as they are. And if you're doing that, you're on the path to cultivate wisdom. You gradually obtain an understanding of things as they are. Seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing. Sensing is just sensing. Things are what they are. Through the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness. So these three doors, good thing to remember, a good basic teaching. Good for Buddhists in ordinary life and great for meditators to remember these three doors. Keep in mind, there's only three things. The four satipatthana is another way of looking at it, but the three doors are a valid way of looking at the cultivation of insight, wisdom, the practice of Buddhism. Certainly for all of us, we have to guard them. Guard the body, guard our speech, guard the mind. It doesn't mean guard like in a prison. It means maintain careful watch over them. Keep them in line. guard our actions. Every time you walk or stand or sit or lie down, then you do anything, do it mindfully. Try, when you speak, try to speak mindfully. When you think, watch your thoughts. Don't let your thoughts get carried away by unmindfulness. This is really the cultivation of the Buddha's teaching. That's all there is to it. That's our Dhamma for tonight. Let's see if we have some questions. Robin, are you prepped? Oh wait, before we have some questions, I've got something to show everyone. I don't even know if it's interesting, but let's see here. Can you see that? Is it backwards?
Ah, there it is. Are you able to move that up a little bit?
Do you see the picture? Oh, you can't read the Thai. This is a Thai newspaper. That's Ajahn Tong. And this is the head of the Buddhist University in Thailand. He's giving him, Ajahn Tong's giving him the Tipitaka in Lana, Northern Thai script. Piti Tawai Ton Chabap Kampi Dika. This is the Dika, the Tikas, the sub-commentaries. Pasabali. This is in Chiang Mai, I think. Actually, I don't know where it is, but it says something about Chiang Mai. Khanat Song. De Khanat Song. Chiang Mai. There it is. Thai. No, this is the Thai version. It's not Lana. That's it. Anyway, here they are. He's and so what they're doing now is they're working on the Anutika, which is the sub commentaries, and so he wants Ajahn Tong asked for it to be transliterated into Lana so they could get a complete set, but the problem is it's not even in Thai, so they have to get it from the Sinhalese script. Apparently, I didn't read the whole article, but I don't quite understand. The push for it, but I wonder if Ajahn Tong is just trying to bring the Sangha together and encourage them in doing good things. I'm not exactly sure how useful the Lana Tipitaka will be, though. I guess it must be. Anyway, I was just looking at it, so I thought I'd share it with you. Questions? I see one at 22 hours.
What does it mean to be attached to Dhamma and to not be attached to Dhamma?
I can't believe these questions coming from a seventh grader. That's impressive. Attached to the Dhamma. Well, I mean, one way people attach to the Dhamma is they cling to teachings after they're no longer useful. So, especially in meditation practice, you'll go through some experience and you'll gain an insight. And it's terribly common to cling to that insight and rejoice in the insight and hold it like a stick, expecting to be able to use it next time. And it doesn't work that way. We can't reuse insight in that way. The real knowledge and insight will stick with you, and it'll change, but it'll also change the playing field. So you'll have to deal with more complicated and more subtle defilements, where the old insights that you gained they're not applicable in that way. You can never just pick something up like a stick and use it. The insights you gain are more a result of the practice, and clinging to them isn't going to help you. You have to remember that, you know, anything you learn in meditation should not be clung to. The Buddha said, good dhammas should not be clung to. How much less bad dhammas, evil, bad things. Good things shouldn't be clung to. How much less should bad things be clung to? So not attaching to the Dhamma is, I think I mentioned this recently, didn't last night? Don't confuse practice and result. So that goes for insight. Insight is the result of the practice. It's not the practice. Don't cling to the Dhamma. Another way people cling to the Dhamma is they cling to textual or theoretical Dhamma, theoretical teachings, and think that they already know the teachings, when in fact they know nothing. Or, you know, they don't really know the teachings. I mean, textual teachings and theoretical teachings can help, and they can instigate true understanding, but the true understanding has to come from meditation practice. There's no other way. You can't find a shortcut. And so people will cling to theory. And if you try and explain to them how to meditate, they will, you know, be able to say, yes, yes, I know all that already. And in fact, they don't know any of it. Because it's all just like a parrot, and they can parrot it back. Those are some ways I can think of that we cling to the Dhamma. Other people, you can also cling to it in terms of thinking the Dhamma is the best, right? You feel proud of the Buddha's teaching, and you go and you use it as a stick to beat other people over the head with, non-Buddhists and so on. The Buddhist jihad, the Sri Lankan, these Czech monks were explaining this to me. There's a Buddhist jihad where new Buddhists, new European or East Western Buddhists will go back home and try and convert all their family. Asian Buddhists do it as well. Ones who find their religion later in life, the born again Buddhists.
Born again and again and again Buddhists.
That's a good one. Born again and again Buddhists.
I do not believe in the concept of rebirth in Buddhism yet, but I'm willing to intensify my practice as I discover rightness of the teachings by myself. Can I experience the cycle of rebirth as truth while practicing meditation? When memories of past lives come up while meditating, how can one perceive them as absolute truth? Thank you for the live streams and videos.
I've given my take on this before several times with some of you. For some of you, this will be a repeat. But no, past life memories, apparently they are reliable. They are not reliable, but they are convincing. A person who has a clear past life memory will be convinced. I mean, how do you know the memories you have of what you did yesterday are not just dreams, are not just illusions, right? There is a difference qualitatively between a memory and a dream, say. It sometimes is blurred, and you can think, that was just a dream I had. You can confuse them. But generally speaking, past life memories, or they can arise that are convincing. But that's not how we understand rebirth. You know, the concept of rebirth is, well, nothing is ever reborn, so it's a misleading name, but there is relinking in the sense of a continuation, that the mind is not dependent entirely on the body. The mind has the power to give rise to new mind. And we see this throughout our lives. An intention that we have gives rise to new existence. You know, hey, maybe I'll run for president, or maybe I'll go back to university, and suddenly there's a whole new series of experiences arising. Now, when you die, that can happen as well. If you still have desire, you'll be reborn based on the mental volition that says, hey, let's do this. So all that is saying is that all it is doing is denying the efficacy or the finality of physical death. And that isn't a leap of faith or even a leap of understanding. As long as you begin with the place where a meditator truly begins to meditate, even after a few days of insight meditation, a few days of intensive insight meditation, with the realization that reality is experiential. It's not based on an external world or the brain or the body or anything. It's based on experience. And if you practice through the foundation course in a tradition like ours, you'll make this paradigm shift. And even though you'll be able to, deal in terms of the concepts and live in terms of concepts of the world around you, you have an understanding that underneath all of that, the reality is just experience. And so the idea of death being somehow final is actually, in and of itself, a leap of faith. From that point of view, it doesn't, there's no evidence or reason to think that, because reality goes according to our experiences, and karma and the fruition of our deeds is all based on experience. It's based on a sequence of experiences. So it's not that we don't believe in, it's not that we believe in rebirth, we just don't believe in death. And there's no reason to believe in death, that's all. Again, you don't have to believe in the concept of life after death, but you should get this sort of argument that I'm making, or get your wrap your head around this, because it helps you understand how we're looking at things, the way that a Buddhist approaches reality. There's no reason to believe in death, is the point. Don't cling to the concept of death, it will be a detriment to your practice. Not that you have to believe in rebirth, just don't cling to the physical world and the body and the brain and that kind of thing, because they're just concepts.
This
Where
is
are
my
you
last
going?
birth.
You missed one, I think. Oh, I don't know, it's just technical one. Someone scheduled a one-on-one meeting with me and I didn't see it. I'm not calling you, so if you schedule a meeting with me, you have to call me. Hopefully you didn't call me and I missed it. But I do check my phone, so if you have a scheduled meeting, you have to call me using Google Hangouts.
Is there still a button that appears on the page, or
There should
do you
be.
strip? But if you're using a phone, I think if you're
It
using a
should
phone, the
appear.
button still appears? Okay.
And it should link you to Hangouts if you're using Android anyway. I
I
don't
know
know.
this is my last birth, as I have been extinguished, but I have no experience to dealing with the situation, and I'm literally waiting it out. I can't teach because I know it is impossible to enlighten others as mine came from the source, and I have to realize that karma transcends intent, and most are intrinsically trapped. What do you suggest I do with my time, as I don't use money and no longer relate to my culture? Thank you.
Well, I guess I'd recommend practicing the Buddha's teaching. I'm not sure if this person even does. You might want to read my booklet on how to meditate. I mean, just you'll have to forgive me that it's easy to say these sorts of things, and it's common to overestimate your progress or misunderstand what it is that leads to rebirth. If it's true that you have actually become an arahant, then well, there's really nothing you have to do. You wait for cessation. But the fact that you're concerned about it in asking this question, in and of itself, there's a, there is a suspicion that you may still have some sort of worry or concern or doubt, which probably wouldn't be present in an arahant. If you have no greed, anger, and delusion, then there's nothing left to do, and there's no sense, of, there's no concern of what you might have to do. So I guess I'd look into that. It's just very easy to say, but if someone tells you this sort of thing on the internet, I think most people would be fairly skeptical. People like me, anyway. So read my booklet, start to practice meditation, and see what happens. Although I'm assuming probably this person's already meditating. Still, I'd recommend reading my booklet if you haven't, and checking out the meditation that we teach. It might show you something you didn't see.
Greetings, venerable sir. Are your students allowed to offer a massage to you? They can give up.
If they're men, I suppose. Not if their name's Kathy. No, I'm not allowed to touch women, and allowing women to touch me, there's some debate about this. Allowing women to touch you, probably not proper, but female doctors, it's considered that they're allowed to touch monks, or monks can allow a female doctor to touch them. I'm not even convinced about that personally, but that's what happens. You go to the hospital and doctors are often women. But monks do massage other monks. It's a common thing to do. Do lay people massage monks? It happens in modern days, and it's not against the Vinaya. But it may not have been so common or so accepted in the Buddhist time. There's no rule against it, so it's probably allowed. Here's this person. Appeared to start a hangout call, and I did waited about 45 minutes. Huh. Strange that it didn't show up on my phone. Usually works. Probably. I mean, I've hinted that I've talked with him about setting up. Remember how we had that built-in video on the web page? That's a really neat setup. I mean, it's cross-browser compatible, and it's ideal, I think. It's the future, so hopefully one day we can get that up and going. But for now, it's just a button and Google Hangouts.
Are you happy? If so, what does motivate you to keep meditating? Thank you.
Well, I don't talk about my own state, my own practice, but if a person is happy, what motivates them to keep meditating? Well, what else would they do? What else is there? Walking and sitting, it's quite a simple and reasonable activity. When there's nothing else to do, that's all you do. Booklet on how to meditate? If so, then you would be mindful of that. You would say to yourself, num, num, or feeling, feeling. I mean, there's going to be some stirring up going on, so some transformation, and there are a lot of feelings that are associated with that transformation when your practice is still at the novice level. You're going to do it wrong, and you'll actually feel bad from the meditation because it's all messed up. It's like learning a sport. If you've ever learned a new sport, it's quite painful in the beginning. Not because playing sports is necessarily painful, but doing it all wrong is quite painful and frustrating. Meditation's very much like that in the beginning. So, but throughout the practice, there will be much sort of change anyway going on in the body and in the mind. So all of these things should not be judged or reacted to. They should be just seen as they are. Feel numb, just say numb, numb. Or feeling, feeling.
At death, I understand that any unresolved attachments may be a cause for reincarnation. Is that also the case with unresolved aversions?
It's a good question. It's a bit abstract, but I don't want to give the wrong answer, technically speaking. I mean, the simple practical answer is that, of course, aversion leads you to do all sorts of things. Aversion will lead you to kill and steal and be reborn. But technically, it's called tanha. But tanha can be desire for non-becoming, desire for something not to be, which is basically a type of aversion, or it's a description of aversion. And I'm not completely clear on that, so don't quote me on that necessarily, but basically, yes, greed, anger, and delusion, they're all that which causes us to be reborn. I mean, at the very least, aversion is going to lead you to want, right? When you're bored, It's because you want something else. You don't like this because you want something else. When you get angry and upset at pain or suffering, the immediate reaction is to try and chase after something that is better, that is nicer, that is more peaceful, a new state. And you've already asked two questions, or more, two questions. Is this actually a person who meditates with us? I'm going to crack down. This person's never meditated on our sites. Let's look at these questions. No, I'm not going to answer them. If you want to ask those questions, you've got to meditate with us first. If you've been meditating our tradition on your own, then just let me know and say, hey, monk, answer my questions, and I will. But for now, not a meditator.
In my practice, if I feel I have been playing the karma card, or just a little more obsessed with the workings of karma, I feel as if I've been playing the karma card, or just a little more obsessed with the workings of karma. Could you explain how the Buddha taught there are four things we should not ponder, that including the working of karma?
I don't know, I mean, is there really that much to explain? It's imponderable because it's very, very complicated. It's the kind of thing only a Buddha could really understand. It's just, it's not just you kill and then in next life, poof, you're killed. It's quite more complicated than that. So don't get obsessed with it. If you find yourself getting obsessed with it, then just say, thinking, or doubting, or confused, obsessed.
I think you're all caught up on questions,
Monty. Yeah, I realize, you know, Frank says he's meditating, right? So he does meditation. Let's answer those two questions then. I don't have a problem
sure.
with it. I just want to, as a rule, you know, discriminate between people who are meditating and aren't meditating. So go ahead.
When facing a recurring situation, how does one discern whether to accept it or to take action to fix it? Is it easier to dissect the situation into acceptable items and action items?
Well, mindfulness. You know, there's no rule book that's going to tell you do this, don't do that. But mindfulness will help you make the right decisions and help you realize when you make the wrong decisions. This is the teaching to Rahula. Before you do something, mindfulness will help you know whether or not to do it. While you're doing something, mindfulness will allow you to see whether you should continue doing something. After you've finished doing something, mindfulness will help you see whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. You shouldn't worry or concern yourself too much about doing the right thing and focus more on maintaining awareness and objectivity. Because objectivity is the greatest tool for making the right decisions. You can't make the wrong decision if you're truly objective. You can do things that have quote-unquote bad consequences, but you know, it's not ethically in a Buddhist sense, it's not ethically potent. It's not wrong if you do something and something bad happens to it, as long as your mind was clear. If your mind was clouded with delusion or greed or anger, then you're culpable for all the bad things you do as a result of those. But if your mind is objective, then you're not doing it out of a bad intention or even an unclear intention. When your mind is clear, you're clearly aware of things. You still might make mistakes because you didn't have all the facts and because the situation was misleading or misled you. But in general, just focus more on your state of mind and don't worry so much about making the right decision. It's more like when your mind is clear, you'll be more careful in making your decisions and you'll just naturally as I was talking about tonight, you'll guard and you'll watch over the three doors. You'll watch over the body. You'll do everything with the body. You know, forget about killing. You'll be aware of every movement of the hand and the feet. Forget about stealing. Forget about lying. You'll be aware of every word that you say and be clearly aware of what it is that you're saying and the nature of those words. But a lot of it is trial and error, you know. Through the great thing about mindfulness is because you're there, you get to see clearly the results of the things you do, and so you learn from your mistakes much better than most people. You're breaking up. I don't know if that's you or me.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Maybe turn off your video, see if that helps.
Sure. What's that?
Same. Go ahead and speak.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now? Okay.
No, still. Didn't this happen to you before?
I think so, yes.
And you fixed it, I thought. Maybe turn down your bandwidth. It says adjust bandwidth. But it's, I don't think it was bandwidth. I think it was like your headset or something. No. I mean, maybe it's at my end. No, but I don't think so. No, because it was good for a bit there. Okay, so yeah, people are asking why we don't have food at the monastery, right? We do have lots of food at the monastery, as it turns out. But there's no one here, and there has been in the past, but right now there's no one here actually giving me food. I'm not allowed to store food for myself, and I can only eat what is given to me in the morning. It's a concession, you know. The idea was to not strive for anything, to not get caught up in seeking things out. So the concession was allowed to eat food that if people actually give it to you. So we have to stick by that. That's the rule. If food is, like, I can't go to a grocery store and pick out food, even if I had an account or, you know, credit at the grocery store. But restaurants, because they actually give food, we can consider that they're giving food on behalf of someone else. And if the restaurant has already been paid for it, then it's a kind of it's stretching the rules. It's certainly not breaking them. It doesn't seem to be breaking them, but it's also certainly not the best way. I mean, ideally, it would be to go on alms round, which of course I could do. In the winter it wouldn't be all that feasible, but I could still do it. In fact, maybe that's what I should start doing, at least in the summer, going on alms round through the village here. It's funny, this morning I met a man. This morning I talked to two people. One of the waitress at the restaurant, she asked about meditation, and she's suffering terribly. Her husband of 23 years just left her, and her children, her child, I don't know, and so she's working as a waitress. She has so much stress, so I said I'd drop off a booklet for her. And then on the way back, I met this guy on a bike, and he's a driving instructor, and we talked, and he took my picture, and he said, "Oh, but don't worry, I won't put it on the internet." And I laughed, and I said, "I'm already on the internet." I explained to him that I teach on the internet, and it was a bit odd, this guy. A bit odd sort of person, but... there are people around, and I met a guy on a bus, and he was pretty obnoxious. Not in a bad way, but in a sort of innocent way, I suppose. He sat behind me, and he loudly, like I was sitting on the bus, and you know, behind me suddenly he starts saying, "So are you Buddhist?" And then the woman beside me got off, and he came and sat down beside me and talked about how great he thought Buddhism was. So I bet if I went on alms round, I could eventually be supported that way. Probably what I should do. Maybe I'll do that this month. But the thing is, I'd do it right now, and I wouldn't get anything, and I would starve as a result. I'd probably die. Hey, maybe not. I might die. I'd probably get quite sick. Weak. So because I've got all these supporters around the world, I kind of decided to cheat and figure something out that way.
Just to clarify too, that was the Dhamma monastery that was donated for meditators because there are meditators that live there.
Right.
So if you go for a meditation course, when you wake up in the morning, you prepare yourself a simple breakfast, and then you prepare yourself lunch, which is actually a lunch that's made by one of the supporters who drops off frozen meals for meditators. So as a meditator, it's very simple. You just make yourself a simple breakfast and then pop in a frozen meal for real lunch. That's why there's a lot of food at the monastery, but it doesn't touch it.
I have touched it when I had to put it away for them. When they and if they bring, the funny thing is, one morning they brought, Grocery Gateway brought big boxes of food, and I accepted them. So suddenly I had two big boxes of food that I could eat. I don't know if that would have been proper because it was, well, no, it said for the monastery and it was given to me, so I'm a part of the monastery.
Before your time.
Sorry?
It was before your time.
Oh yeah, it was like 9 o'clock or something. I think I had some orange juice out of that.
Nice. And then there was another question from someone as to how much the meals cost with the dining services at the university. And that there isn't a set fee. It's not like, actually, I remember when I was in college many years ago, they actually had a sort of an all-you-can-eat plan. You just pay the price and you just pay everything. Super simple. I wish it was like that at McMaster, but apparently it's not. Apparently there are many different places to eat, and what your meal will cost depends on where you go and what's selected, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's not a flat fee. It's depending on the meal.
I think it's like $30 a day, total food.
Yeah,
maybe 35.
What you had mentioned when you were using the food gift cards, it was running about $30 per day. Now, that is $30 Canadian. So that's more like $22, $24 American, something like that. About $24 American. But when I put together the campaign for anyone who would like to offer food for Monday, I did it based on an estimate of $100 Canadian or $75 American. That's where the whole amount came up to. And actually, that campaign for people to offer food is doing really, really well in just one day, and it was offered to pay for about 6 months worth of meals for you. So that is super. So thank you very much, everyone. It was awesome.
Thanks for the food. I can't say thanks for the money, because it's not my money and I can never have anything to do with it.
It'll just be a card that you can use to meals supported, paid for by your supporters. Is there a question to you?
All right, last question, then we're going.
Okay. Is kriya when you do something but have no karma? If so, is it based on intention?
It's what an arahant, it's the mind of an arahant, it's kriya. Or kriya, maybe it is spelled kriya. In Thai they say kriya. But I seem to remember it might be pronounced kriya as well. Kriya means that which is simply done. So yes, there's no karma because arahants don't cultivate karma. Even when they do good deeds, there is no attachment to the deed, and so they don't have any. It's non-productive of a result. It's considered to be wholesome. But it's wholesome without a result. Sobhana, it's not wholesome maybe. Sobhana, kusala vipaka. It's not called wholesome, I don't think. It's called sobhana kriya. Kriya, probably, right? Kriya. Yep, it's part of Abhidhamma. Clearly this person is studying the Abhidhamma, so they know, or they've heard about this from the Abhidhamma. In the Abhidhamma, kriya is one of the three types of minds. There's the kusala, three kinds of sobhana. So you have the kusala, which is the deed that you do. When you do something, when you have a good intention to do a good deed, like give a gift, that's kusala. The result is called kusala vipaka. And when you do it but are an arahant, then it's called kriya. Because there's a missing sort of intention. Yeah, after the Visuddhimagga we should study the Abhidhammata Sangha. It's a really good book because of the explanations by Bhikkhu Bodhi, really well done. So that's a good introduction to the Abhidhamma, which is neat to learn about. A lot of Westerners like to learn about the Abhidhamma. Anyway, that's all for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for your help. Wishing you all a good night.